Like all my countrymen, I am overjoyed to see the last of Mengistu, and I am willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the new regime. But we cannot take their assurances for granted. A look at the program of the EPDRF shows why. It calls for a multi-party system, but says the rights of the remnants of the anti-democratic feudal class and the fascist derg need to be curtailed up to and including denying these sectors the right to participate. Using that kind of language, it would be an easy matter to label whomever you wish as feudal or fascist remnants and take away their rights.
That's Jonas de Ressa speaking at a U.S. hearing in 1991. As the communist regime was being defeated in Ethiopia's civil war, political groups on all sides of the conflict lobbied the U.S. for recognition. But it didn't end there. Opposition groups continued to sway U.S. elected officials into holding hearings on Ethiopia.
It's a very serious issue, and all U.S. strategic interests are going to be affected by what happens in Ethiopia. So the question is, if we let things go the way they are, would we at least achieve the strategic objectives of the U.S., which in this case means a stable Ethiopia that can support the anti-terrorist struggle in the region? And the answer that I can give is, unfortunately, the way things are going, that's not going to happen, because Ethiopia itself is going to be destabilized, because after 21 years, people have become so traumatized. People have literally given up hope that there is a possibility of peaceful transition, that there is now more recourse towards armed resistance against the state. Now, you can imagine, once armed resistance starts, you don't even know which direction it takes.
That's Dr. Bruhanu Nega speaking at a U.S. hearing in 2013. And more recently in 2017, Deacon Yosef Teferi and Gaia Deke were part of a team that lobbied the U.S. to pass a resolution threatening aid assistance and sanctions against Ethiopian government officials.
Immediate halt of direct foreign aid to the Ethiopian government, especially direct budgetary assistance. And all humanitarian assistance should be applied to a direct humanitarian organization on the ground, preferably the United Nations Food Program.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Diki, you have any recommendations for the United States?
I would say, if United States doesn't give due recognition for this dictatorship as elected government.
To understand how U.S. hearings became a battleground for opposition groups, we have to go back in time to Ethiopia's student movement. And yes, we really have to go that far back. Dr. Paulos Milkias narrates that history for us. He was one of the movement's leaders and is an author of a number of books on Ethiopian history. He is also a low-key member of Ethiopia's royal family.
We wanted to overthrow the feudal system in Ethiopia, because at that time people believed in Haile Selassie was like next to God. And it was very hard for us to actually reach the ordinary people, the peasants, to make them be aware that there are things that are better. With the Ethiopian students' movement, it's like all the university students. The first one to be assassinated was actually the emperor's son-in-law. You know, you won't believe it. Someone came and shot him in the evening. Revolutionaries do not necessarily come from working-class people. Children of those aristocracy or those privileged people, after reading and understanding the situation, we actually rebel against their own system. That was what happened in Ethiopia. Our aim was not to bring about Marxism, Leninism, or socialism, or anything. We wanted a democracy, but the government of Haile Selassie never allowed a democracy. There was no political party. You couldn't express your views. It was a very, very absolute monarchy. Haile Selassie controlled everything. 97% of the Ethiopian population at that time were illiterate. Imagine, 97%. So we said we have to teach the peasants how to read and write, literacy, how to rebel against the feudal system. Some of our colleagues, in order to make the workers conscious, went and started to work like a proletariat, like workers. For example, in Akaki, textile factory and so on and so forth. And in the meantime, educate the workers in the factories to rebel against the system. So now what was happening was that the workers, now we are becoming more and more conscious. The peasants were slowly becoming conscious of their rights. And then the military officers, the young ones especially, were being converted. At the same time, there was the war in the north, in Eritrea. There was also war in the Ogaden, in the Somali area. And Ethiopian soldiers were like tens of thousands of them were deployed over there. And they were neglected. You see, many of these ordinary soldiers, some of them for decades, nobody actually cared about them. The generals were the ones who were actually enjoying themselves, okay, having the best of everything. And these soldiers were demoralized. They were alienated because of that. Some of our colleagues had already created consciousness among them. And so they went on strike. They arrested their own generals and demanded that proper food be given to them, that they have to be given an opportunity to actually be rotated so that they could see their families, because many of them left their families in Addis Ababa. This movement was actually led by young officers below the rank of major. Like Mengistu Haile Mariam was just a captain. So they created a committee to come to Addis Ababa to appeal to Emperor Haile Selassie so that many of the demands that the soldiers had in Eritrea, in southern Ethiopia, in the Ogaden, would be solved, because you go to the emperor whenever there is a problem. That is how they came. But by the time they actually arrived in Addis Ababa and were representing their petition to the emperor, there also came a famine, very big famine in Wollo province, as well as the province of Tigray. And hundreds of thousands of people died. Some were even saying that this may be about 1 million people died. Emperor Haile Selassie and his government did not ask for food aid from countries that could actually provide it, like Canada, the United States, and so on. They didn't want to show that Ethiopia has got this kind of problem. When Princess Radha Kasa's daughter, when she got married, they had, like, you know, they exchanged millions of dollars worth of gifts, you know, in her name. At the same time, there was famine. And they actually had a cake which was done, prepared in London, and they brought it by airplane, private plane. But when the plane, when it came, it was broken, like, you know, to half broken, you know, the cake. And they say, oh, no, we have to mend it. But they were afraid of destroying its structure. So they took it back to England to actually mend it. I mean, imagine, they were caring more about how a cake looked like at a marriage than those people who didn't have any food to eat, any jarawa or anything. They were drying like leaves. And the children were suckling the breast of their dead mother. These are the kind of things that they actually showed. Thames television, it was shown on the BBC. 90% of the Ethiopian peasants had no land of their own. They were serfs working on land belonging to big landowners, absentee landowners. Peasants used to produce their food. They brought and gave 75% of what they produced to the landlord. So they were left with, like, you know, peanuts, literally. That was one of the reasons why many of them were dying of famine. And we said, this is not right. Land to the tiller. Land to the tiller. Haile Selassie was very, very much respected internationally because of his fight against the fascists, against Mussolini, and because of his creation of the Organization of African Unity. And so at one time he almost won the Nobel Prize, you know, for peace. So he was very, very highly regarded. Now they said, ah, look, Haile Selassie is actually allowing these peasants to die. So internationally, the support for Haile Selassie and his regime was gone. Imagine all this happening at the same time. That was what actually led to the revolution. The military were the only ones who had the guns. The students were more or less like catalysts, but the military had the guns. They realized that the governments of Haile Selassie could not survive without the military supporting them. And so all of a sudden they supported the students' movement, the radical student movement. They arrested all these important people. And Haile Selassie now was completely helpless because, I mean, if he can't use his military, the military, the police, all of them were together. After that, of course, the students' union were divided also, unfortunately. One group said that we'll work with the military, with Mengistu Haile Mariam and those groups, and continue to radicalize them with the hope that in the long run, that they themselves would actually take over power as civilians. Another group called the EPRP, Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Party, said the military is a fascist junta and we have to overthrow it. We have to create what is called a provisional government. And after that, the military has to return back to its barracks. But mind you, I mean, these guys, these were like, you know, I mean, corporals, some of them were even ordinary soldiers. You know, those who actually were members of the DIRG, 120 of them. There were a few officers, actually. Large numbers of them were not even officers. And they came and all of a sudden power in their own hands. Now, you want them to actually leave that power, there was no way. And they knew that they were the ones who were, the only ones who were carrying the guns. The APRP started to assassinate supporters of the Mengistu regime, the DIRG, including radical students like Meeson, who were educating Mengistu and his group. One was what is called the White Terror. What was called the Red Terror was what the government was doing to the EPRP. They literally wiped them out. Thousands and thousands. They say maybe at a minimum about 150,000 young people were mowed down. Whenever they killed their opponent, there was a song, a traditional song, that's Mari sing. Yefi yer wadat e teke shaya bata, lubuya bata bata. When they killed General Amanandom, that was they played. When they killed the generals, that was they played. The moment people hear that, they would just, you know, be scared. And Mengistu actually gave them what he called free hand. These Kabbalists were like neighborhood associations that were armed by the DIRG. And they said, take decisions on your own. You don't have to come to government police. If you think that they are radicals against the DIRG and against the system, what they call Abiyot, they were calling it Abiyot actually means revolution, kill them. That is what was happening. Like they were killing them left and right. They didn't even know, you see, about the revolution. They were just rising against the DIRG. And so that was what was happening, you see, at that time.
Now, once the EPRP was destroyed completely, then Meeson remained, and the Mengistu and the DIRG were afraid of Meeson slowly taking over power because ideologically they were the ones who were training the political party, the Workers' Party. And they were also training, for example, ideologically, the militia, the open militia, numbering over 300,000. And they were the ones who were saying that they had their cadres. The Meeson, nor the EPRP, which was leftist, left wing, both of them were Marxists, by the way. They didn't have arms. It's only later on they started to buy guns and they tried to use it. But it's not like the army. The DIRG was like the Ethiopian military. Okay? It was already organized. And so when the militia was being created to fight against the Somalis, and again, the EPLF in Eritrea, at that time, Mengistu and his group were afraid that Meeson was becoming very influential and they may use the militia to overthrow them, to overthrow the DIRG, which is a military. And so they destroyed him. In the Meeson, you find more Oromos. In the EPRP, you find more Eritreans, actually, to be Tigrinya-speaking Eritreans. But at that time, really, it didn't matter. Whoever was radical would actually join one group or the other.
Now let's fast forward 17 years to the 1991 U.S. hearing, when the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front took over. The party is also known by its acronym EPRDF. Here's Herman Cohen, who at the time was the United States Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, describing the U.S. decision to endorse the party despite objections from opposition groups.
A series of new offensives by the EPRDF removed three more provinces from government control, and the front began to close in on Addis itself. Mengistu's government clearly was powerless to reverse the encroaching tide, or even hold it off more than briefly. The question was no longer whether the government would survive, but whether there'd be a bloody battle for the capital before the regime changed. Government officials urged the U.S. to help facilitate a peaceful transition. They affirmed a keen desire to include rebel groups and others in a restructured regime. The day before the London meeting formally was to begin, the Ethiopian government's forces had lost their ability to offer any organized opposition, and the only thing keeping the EPRDF out of the capital was the insurgents' own decision to hold back while the London talks were going on. On the 27th, acting president Tesfaye Gebre-Kidan told us the Ethiopian army had virtually disintegrated, and that he and senior government officials were extremely concerned about their ability to provide for law and order. The acting president said that the government intended to broadcast a call for a unilateral ceasefire and an appeal to the citizens of Addis to accept the EPRDF when they entered the capital. The EPRDF decided to move into the city that night. The United States agreed with that decision because the EPRDF was now left as the only disciplined force capable of keeping order in the capital. At that point, the Addis regime effectively ceased to exist, and their delegation in London dropped out of the talks.
There to protest was Goshu Wolde. He was the foreign minister under the Derg until he defected in 1986. Here he is expressing his frustrations at the way the London conference was handled.
The Confab brought together ethnically based armed groups who are the sworn enemies of the Ethiopian nation state and have formed an alliance to dismember and tear down that very state. Those groups with a multi-ethnic base who enjoy the broad support of the Ethiopian people, the vast majority of people who do not belong to any of these political groupings, either armed or political, were pointedly and deliberately excluded.
4 years later, he would lead a group known as the Medhin Party in a rebellion to remove EPRDF from power, according to a report by the Washington Post. A month earlier, consultant Paul Henze spoke at another U.S. hearing.
When it comes to getting everybody together and encouraging democracy, here too, I think the principle is quite clear. We'd like to have everybody together. But if there are movements that out of petty motivation, stubborn self-serving reasons, or because of quarrels in the past, refuse to cooperate, they simply have to stand on the sidelines. We don't want to encumber our government with requirements that they give hearing to every last element that insists on having hearing but doesn't really cooperate.
The EPRDF has proceeded to establish an interim administration in Addis, which is working with the existing civil service to reestablish essential services and has assured the donor community that relief will be given first priority. The group in Addis has made reassuring public statements about its commitments to democracy. It seems to be extending its hand to other political groups inside and outside Ethiopia.
So how has EPRDF done since that 1991 hearing? Well, let's start with political freedoms.
All the four political parties that made up, that created this coalition that I referred to as Coalition for Unity and Democracy, happened to be founded upon very much nationalistic pan-Ethiopian principles. So they all had the name Ethiopia in their party's name. And then they came together and created this Coalition for Unity and Democracy. So unity was very much at the center of everything they did. So there were, at the time, there are other opposition groups that have also formed their own coalition. And you could find there, you know, Oromo political parties, you know, or Sidama political parties, or, you know, political parties that are founded according to, you know, ethnic affiliations and all that. But CUD, it was very much different.
That's Dr. Yohannes Gedamu. He fled Ethiopia after the 2005 election due to fears of being targeted for his affiliation with CUD. He is now a political science professor in the U.S. Dr. Gedamu says CUD had a diverse ethnic makeup, but a 2007 report by the South African think tank Accord says CUD was mainly viewed as a coalition of Amhara parties. And a quick search of the leaders reveal they have old roots in Ethiopian politics. Halu Shaw, who led the party in 2005, had served in multiple offices under the Derg regime, according to the U.S.-based media outlet Ethiosport. Another one of its leaders was Professor Mesfin Woldemiriam, who had been lobbying the U.S. to reject EPRDF as a legitimate party long before EPRDF came to power. Another prominent member was Dr. Berhanu Nega. We heard him earlier in the episode testifying at the U.S. hearing. He had been a member of the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Party in the 1970s before he fled the country. Another faction of the coalition, called the United Ethiopian Democratic Party, Medhin Party, had set out to overthrow the EPRDF government 10 years earlier. That's the party Goshu Wolde from earlier in the episode was affiliated with. CUD's major campaign themes were eliminating ethnic federalism, removing Article 39 from the Constitution, according to the report by Accord. Article 39 is the provision that allows nations and nationalities the right to secede from Ethiopia. Dan Obrahane is editor of the Horn Affairs news site. He says another big theme of CUD's was calling for the privatization of land and for free markets. Observers of the 2005 elections describe it as mostly fulfilling international expectations for democratic elections. The liveliness of the debates televised and the extent of the discourse allowed, including the right to challenge Ethiopia's ethnic federalism, was more than anyone had hoped for. The opposition even won 173 of the 546 seats in parliament. It also won full control of the capital city.
The electoral campaign was very much democratic. The government, no one believes it to this day, opened up the political space for opposition parties.
But then things turned chaotic when EPRDF announced it won the majority nationally, before all the votes had been tallied, says Dr. Gedamu.
That creates, of course, a huge problem.
But Daniel Brahane says EPRDF made the announcement to counter the claims of the opposition.
The vote counting was going on. While the vote counting was going on, the opposition said they are winning. And EPRDF said, no, I am winning.
He says the official statement from the election board came much later. After the elections, a number of CUD members refused to take their seats, according to the BBC, including the elected mayor at the time, Dr. Nega. CUD continued to proclaim it won the majority vote, and it organized protests that ended up turning violent, resulting in an estimated 200 deaths, according to government figures. Some of the members were imprisoned for continuing protest, but they were later released. The U.S.-based nonprofit Carter Center observed the 2005 elections, and it said EPRDF had won the majority despite irregularity in voting at some of the locations. A 2009 WikiLeaks cable suggests the U.S. agreed with the Carter Center's assessment. Roughly 85% of Ethiopians live in rural areas, according to the nonprofit Freedom House, which means a majority win was still possible for EPRDF without the capital city. Former Prime Minister Meles Zenawi said international observers had encouraged the violence. According to the cable, the U.S. acknowledges this point by citing EU parliamentarian Ana Gomes as an election observer who falsely declared the opposition winners of the majority vote. Daniel Brahane also shares the view that EU observers had overstepped their role. He says CUD had been organized as a party for a short time before the election and that it lacked institutional support for a majority win. He also said the party overestimated how far Westerners were willing to go to support them and that the protests were staged to intimidate EPRDF into relinquishing power. A 2007 WikiLeaks cable supports this point. It says the CUD was having an internal dispute about whether to pursue change through the democratic institutions or by popular protests that would oust EPRDF. At the time, Ethiopia had a winner-take-all system, also known as first-past-the-post. Here's what that means.
A party may come to power with, let's say, getting 51%, but the 49% that were defeated are out.
Earlier this year, Ethiopia adopted proportional representation into its electoral system, which means the party with the majority will have to give up more seats, says Dr. Melkias.
But if there is proportional representation, the party that wins 51% may get 3 seats. But the 49% that didn't, let's say, for example, the Madrak party now, would get at least 1 seat and so on. Then what would happen is that in parliament, you will have a majority of the EPRDF, definitely, because they are still in power. But you will have maybe at least 1/3 or even half, okay, or 40%, whatever, from other parties.
EPRDF also has affiliate parties outside of its constituency base. This detail is drowned out by critics when explaining the party's control of parliament. Here's Tedros Tefray of the Amhada Association of America refusing to acknowledge the separate identities of the affiliate parties who won seats in his response to U.S. Representative Karen Bass.
In the last election, there were numerous televised debates during which all sorts of political issues were voiced and argued between the candidates. This is in contrast to the notion that there's been diminished political space.
Representative Bass, the TPLF-led political party won 100% of all parliamentary seats in 2015.
They won 500 out of 546.
Yeah, 100%. And in the regional seats, 100% also. So imagine...
Human Rights Watch and some media outlets also failed to present this accurately in their reports on the 2015 elections, demonstrating the stronghold opposition groups have in crafting the international perception of EPRDF and current political conditions in the country. Somali region native Mohamed Olid says affiliate parties do not benefit from this structure.
The ESDP party, the party that controls the Somali region, just it gets its legitimacy from the fact that it's just associated with EPRDF. If you're missing at that table, you're actually missing big time. The parliament, the federal cabinet, and the executive branch, and all that stuff, they're just like a rubber stamp for whatever EPRDF actually decides. So in some way, the fate of the Somalian people is being decided by EPRDF and those who are at that table.
Why do people join them? There is power in the first place. They would exercise power. Who would not be attracted by power even if it's limited? There is the glory of office as well. There is also benefits, financial benefits. But most importantly, people get in there for self-improvement, self-aggrandizement. Now, why is that important? In a country like Ethiopia, where when you are educated, your chances of becoming employed and earn a living is the public sector, where the private sector is not even 10%. Anybody who goes to a university and gets a degree would want to have an employment. The government has or controls about 90% of the employment that's available to anyone. So they use party mechanisms to make sure that people join them and remain.
That was Dr. Ezekiel Gabisa. EPRDF has jailed opposition members, but most reports say jailed members refuse to renounce violence and will not agree to adhere to Ethiopian laws. There hasn't been any reliable reports of retaliation, torture, or extrajudicial killings. EPRDF even pardoned a significant number of former Derg officials. That's a stark difference from the Communist Party before it, who routinely murdered and tortured opponents. Here's former Prime Minister Meles Zenawi addressing allegations of abuse in his interview with Al Jazeera in 2010.
No independent observer has said, I have observed such and such acts of intimidation. No one. All of them report allegations of intimidation. And by some magic wand, transform these allegations into facts.
They do tolerate, really, as long as you are not a member of any party that they consider to be threatening to them. They themselves say that those who want to overthrow the government by force or whatever, there are groups that actually do that.
That was Dr. Milkias. Despite EPRDF's many concessions with political groups over the years, opposition groups have painted a much darker picture of the party. Here's Deacon Yusuf Tafari speaking at an anti-government rally in Aurora, Colorado.
No more war!
No!
No more slavery!
No!
No more fascists!
No!
Make Ethiopia live forever and ever!
Now let's move on to EPRDF's track record on press freedoms.
Right now, there is no independent press or free press, and which is very, very dangerous, because in the absence of free press, independent press, where no one could keep the government or the ruling coalition accountable for what it does, or even the opposition, you know, accountable for what they do, right? Now, most of the people, they rely on social media to get their news. And you know how difficult that it is. Sometimes, you know, the information that you receive is very much distorted, biased, and maybe even baseless. And we have seen what social media and, you know, fake news, right, could do to countries like, you know, the United States. So that has created a huge problem.
The U.S.-based watchdog Freedom House cites Ethiopia as being one of the most restrictive media environments in sub-Saharan Africa. In 2016, the government had 16 journalists detained, according to the organization's website. Critics say Ethiopia has used its terrorism law to counter dissent, but the Ethiopian government has said those arrested acted unprofessionally and were calling for insurrection against the state, and says that they are linked to the outlawed groups Gimbo 7, Oromo Liberation Front, and the Ogaden National Liberation Front. A quick review of the work of some of those journalists who were arrested supports the government's claims. Take the case of blogger Eskender Nega. In his writings, he suggested the military's loyalty is to the ruling party, called for the pardon of former Derg officials, claims EPRDF is using aid money to buy votes, says Ethiopians are nostalgic for the era of Mengistu Haile Mariam, and questions EPRDF's patriotism. But it was his warning of an African spring in Ethiopia that really put government officials on edge. The photo for the article has former Libyan ruler Colonel Muammar Gaddafi warning Prime Minister Meles Zenawi that his turn is next. Colonel Gaddafi was captured and brutally murdered in 2011 by opposition groups. The opposition groups were led by Libyans in the diaspora, and they were backed by NATO forces. Civil war has continued in Libya since. Yet, Western organizations like the U.S.-based Committee to Protect Journalists have long championed his case. The Committee to Protect Journalists has also championed the case of Dawit Kabede, who was arrested and later released for his reporting during the 2005 election. According to a 2008 WikiLeaks cable, the U.S. found Dawit breached the Ethiopian government's, quote, legitimate sensitivities, quote, end, when he reported on the government's attempts to prevent him from publishing news on Gimbo 7, and said his actions showed a clearer need for greater professionalism. The civil war in Ethiopia was largely fought along ethnic lines. That reality, the strife it created in Ethiopian politics, and the hounding calls of opposition groups for a return to pre-EPRDF days is often dismissed by Western observers. Here's Dr. Terrence Lyons of George Mason University giving his take at the 2017 U.S. hearing.
That does not mean that the regime is going to collapse. This isn't regime change. This isn't going in and bombing Benghazi or sending troops into Iraq. This is getting them to provide space so that Ethiopians who care about democracy and human rights are able to speak about those things. And it would be a very, very precariously perched regime that thought that that was what was going to lead to chaos. The Zone 9 bloggers are an example of that, a young group of Ethiopians who blogged in a way that was critical of the regime, and the regime was very, very unhappy about that and regarded them as criminal. Well, if you're worried about a group of young people who are blogging, then you know how you've just got 100% of the seats in parliament. You have the strongest military in sub-Saharan Africa, one of the strongest militaries. There's a disconnect there. Why are you so worried about being criticized if, in fact, you are the control and not the chaos?
The EPRDF's muddled response to protests in the Oromia and Amhara regions and the heightened ethnic targeted violence has led careful observers to believe there is a schism within the party. There have also been reports of party officials collaborating with opposition groups to encourage dissent. In 2011, then Prime Minister Meles Zenawi told the Indian-based ITMN television that internal party politics had been his biggest challenge.
What is it that really stretched you and you felt that it was very challenging? Was it the time that you had to clamp down and over 100 civilians lost their lives? Or was it the war that you had to go through? Or was it the Nile water issue the most challenging that you've had to face?
Well, all of those were very challenging. 17 years of armed struggle against very well entrenched regime could not but be challenged. The border war we had with Eritrea was a challenge. Disturbances we had in 2005 after the elections was a heart-rending challenge. And there were many other challenging periods. But for me, the most important challenge has been one that is not noticed by everybody, not noticed by anybody indeed, which is the internal party debate on how to move forward and where to move, which was conducted some 10 years ago.
So you're not talking about the time after the war with Eritrea, where you had the internal party challenge?
That is immediately after the end of the war with Eritrea. We had a very challenging situation within the party. The party was almost was on the verge of disintegration. In the end, we scraped through. And as they say, the darkest moment in the night is just before dawn. And a few years later, 1 or 2 years later, we began this cycle of double-digit growth rates.
A 2015 World Bank report cites Ethiopia's economic growth as strong and sustained, and averaging 10.9% annually. It calls the pace of poverty reduction in Ethiopia since 2000 impressive, says it's one of the most equal countries in the world. But the report also acknowledges widespread poverty throughout the country and that some households have had higher poverty rates in recent years. China has been helping Ethiopia, Dr. Melkias says, who is currently working on a book about the subject.
The Chinese want to make Ethiopia a showcase for Africa. They are pouring billions and billions of dollars to Ethiopia. The roads that are being built, the high-rises that are being built, it's incredible. You can actually see. The GDP of Ethiopia, according to the World Bank, has doubled, okay, in 10 years. Okay, the amount of money that the country actually generates. All that with the help of the Chinese. It's not limited to Ethiopia. The Chinese are also in Angola, they are in Nigeria, they are in Congo, They're all over Africa, as a matter of fact. Even though they claim that they have got a democratic system in Ethiopia, they know that they are using an authoritarian system. The example that the Mullah Zenawi and his followers actually follow is a Chinese example. But the Chinese do not deny that they are, they are following Marxism-Leninism, which is a dictatorship or communist dictatorship, but they have developed the country in 30 years. They actually made China the second largest economy in the world, most powerful, as a matter of fact. Some even say that they have surpassed the United States, if you actually consider the purchasing power parity. So they developed it that way. And so Mullahs and his group actually say the same thing. There are other countries that developed also, in Asia, Singapore. Singapore did not develop under democracy. They developed under what is called the Lee hypothesis, one party controlling power. They have good elections, but they get elected again and again and again. Taiwan developed under Chiang Kai-shek dictatorship, not under democracy. South Korea had a series of dictators, military dictators, that actually ruled it at the time it developed and reached this level. Malaysia is a monarchy. Again, it's not a democracy. That's an example. You sacrifice democratic rights for economic development. Because if you actually give freedom, everything, whatever, you may not be able to actually control what happens.
Western institutions have been pushing Ethiopia to privatize public sectors. Shortly before his death in 2012, Prime Minister Meles Zenawi argued at the World Economic Forum against privatizing key sectors too soon in Africa and called democracy the key to maintaining African unity.
My view is that in Africa, most of our countries are extremely diverse. That may be the only possibility, the only option of keeping relationships within nations same. Democracy may be the only viable option for keeping these diverse nations together. So we need to democratize, not in order to grow. We need to democratize in order to survive as united, same nation.
One thing that strikes me about Ethiopia right now.
That's Dr. Edmund Keller. He's a longtime commentator and observer of Ethiopian history and politics.
It's impressive the kind of progress that's been made in terms of infrastructure and in terms of education and so forth and so on. But if you sort of peel away the skin on that onion, what you're going to find is that poverty also continues to increase. So the rich are getting richer, and some folks feel that those that are dominating are the ones that are spreading the wealth to their own folks.
This view is widely held by critics of EPRDF. Here's Dr. Bruhanu Nega speaking at the U.S. hearing.
I would like to suggest to anyone who is dealing with Ethiopia to be very, very cautious about what kind of numbers they are playing. I mean, international experts come up and then talk about how things are improving. It is very hazardous. I'm an economist by training, and I know how these numbers are put together. So it would be better to be careful about that, cautious about that. But
the World Bank and the IMF actually are the ones who actually put these figures. They wouldn't actually take a cooked, economic whatever. You see it clearly, very clearly. If you go there, you see it. Okay? But these people who actually say that have never gone and seen. And even if they have seen it, they actually hide. They don't want to show it. To admit that the TPLF or the EPRDF is developing Ethiopia would actually go against their political interest. But what I say is that, you see, let us be frank. Let us see if something is wrong. Okay? For example, the area of ethnicity, in the area of human rights, in the area of democratization. They have a long way to go. Even they themselves know it. They say, we're improving, they say. But economic development, you see it, you can't deny that.
Even with the growth, there are downsides to the state development model, says Dr. Gedemu.
That is money injected from loans and credits, and it has also repercussions. And I think the economic growth could be encouraging, but I don't think it will be sustainable. The growth may be fine, but I would rather prefer slowing of the economic growth and growth of our political freedoms. Because when people are free, when there's a fair tax system, when there's property rights, the economy could grow again. But right now, it has caused, you know, corruption. It has caused so many problems because of these state enterprises like really dominating the economy.
In either case, opposition groups and critics of the government seem willing to say or do anything to remove EPRDF from power. Here's more of the conversation that took place at the U.S. hearing.
In many times in Los Angeles, my constituents would like for me to support the termination of all foreign aid, even humanitarian assistance. I have difficulty with that notion because I am concerned that, you know, their point of argument is that it never gets to the people it's supposed to get to. And I guess what makes me fearful with that is that I don't want to play into forces here that are hostile to foreign aid. And if it gets to some, then is that not better than others? And you, I think both of you made a statement that you thought foreign aid should be conditioned on making progress. One, do you think the foreign aid gets to the people, to some of the people who need it? And then two, if it's conditioned on making progress, number one, what would those conditions be and how would anybody verify?
I do not support ending all aid, and particularly humanitarian aid, because I do think it makes a tremendous difference on the ground. There were some 10 million people in Ethiopia following the El Nino drought of 2014 or 15, who were able to survive, in part because of the generosity of the United States and other donors. We also, an important part of our aid package is for things like HIV/AIDS and PEPFAR money, right, education programs. I mean, you can go out to regional medical centers and see that that's the things that USAID has done. You can see the work on regional universities and on other things.
That was U.S. Representative Karen Bass speaking to Dr. Terrence Lyons. And here's U.S. Representatives Thomas Garrett and Thomas Swasey commenting on the potential risk of House Resolution 128. That's the resolution that passed earlier this year. It calls for aid to be conditional on expanding the political space, international monitoring of human rights conditions, and U.S. sanctions on certain government officials when necessary.
If the EPRDF is a strong regime, which in some ways it is, 8 million members of the party, 100% seats in the parliament, one of Africa's most effective militaries and peacekeeping and so on and so forth, double-digit growth, it may also be a very brittle party that once challenged could very quickly, the veneer collapses and the underlying structures cannot stand. So that would be the concern I would have for a vacuum, that if the ruling party can't hold it together because it's under too much pressure, then what? And so it's not that we need to put pressure on...
So, you know, I know I'm interrupting, but with all due respect, that's my question.
Mm-hmm.
Then what? If the ruling party fractures and there's a vacuum, who rushes in to fill that vacuum?
Very hard to know. My best expectation, it's really a guess rather than even a very strong conclusion, is that the organizations in Ethiopia that have the ability to mobilize are, one, ethnically based political parties that are part of the ruling coalition. So some of the power might gravitate back to the ethnic regions, and it would be weaker centrally. And two, the Ethiopian military.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'd yield back in a moment. I want to be very clear, though. My concern is that in pushing Ethiopia to be a better actor as it relates to openness, freedom of the press, etc., that we accidentally create a vacuum that creates chaos beyond that which we currently imagine. So everybody, I think, on both sides of the aisle, wants to see free and fair democratic societies across the globe. But sometimes if we push and something falls off that ledge, what steps in to fill the vacuum is not any better than what it precedes, and oftentimes, unfortunately, is worse.
Places that are stable versus places that are unstable. And so many places in the world today that were once propped up by the Soviets or by the Americans during the Cold War that are average or sub-average governments, or that are either incompetent or corrupt or just lack resources, are not able to survive in the current environment. Because it's easy to be, as he described, a breaker in the world as it is to be a maker. And a lot of places end up with, because of climate change and the droughts, such as you're experiencing in Ethiopia, with 80% of the people involved in agriculture, and there's these terrible droughts, and so many people are suffering, and then they move into the cities, and they're looking for a better life, but they can't find it there, and there's civil unrest, and there becomes political foment, and you've got we've gone from 35 million refugees in the world to 65 million refugees in the past 10 years. And so if there is a movement to make this change, but as a result, there's terrible unrest and destability that takes place in the country as a result. You've got another hotspot and another source of refugees in the world that have really few places to go.
Deacon Yosef Tafari, who helped lead the call to pass the resolution, says it's meant to save Ethiopia.
I hope that's not the case, where we will have a state that collapses and that there is a political vacuum that is created and anarchy rules the day. I hope to God that's not what happens in Ethiopia. And that's why we all get involved now to avoid those kind of situations. That happens when you exhaust every layer of possibilities for a transitional process to take into effect. This stubbornness, this unwillingness to come to the table, is emboldened by Western donor countries. So we need to make a stop to that so that this dictatorship is starved.
Here's Dr. Nega speaking at the 2013 U.S. hearing.
Respect your constitution. Just respect the constitution that you have written.
We're trying to get that done here. But
I don't know. I really want you to take something very, very seriously, Ms. Paz. What I see is conflict. What I see is war. What I see is a civil war coming to Ethiopia. Okay. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I want to testify today, and I want you to take this seriously. Okay. Because this country is not going into the same way that it has gone over the last 21 years. I think people are fed up. I think people are going to fight. And nobody can blame people for fighting against tyranny. That is where it's going.
Do you think that there is an organized... do you think the opposition is organized enough to actually wage that?
I do believe that the opposition...
conflicts in the existing government.
Yes, I do believe that the opposition that was fractured has started to seriously talk about mounting a unified challenge. That's what is going to happen. And that's why I'm trying to be more, if you might call it alarmist, in the sense that if people in the policy-making apparatus think that you can't just keep going the way you are going about it, a surprise is coming to you.
At the time of the hearing, Dr. Nega had already been leading Gimbo 7, a party that the Ethiopian government has labeled as a terrorist group because of its mission to overthrow the government.
Their number one disagreement with the PRDF is allowing nations, nationalities, and peoples to form their own state and local governments. It's against their interest.
That's Dr. Weldu Weldayesus.
They are completely against the constitution. They are completely against the formation of regional states along linguistic and geographical lines. But this has changed in such a way that there will be no return at all. If the state of emergency was not declared, if the PRDF were to collapse for some reason, the interest of the extreme Amharic speaking opposition political parties would do is they would just completely throw away the constitution and create their own constitution, and then create states similar to what they had during the imperial era.
I initially wasn't going to include that last comment, but then I stumbled upon a number of videos of the anti-government protest. In the videos, the protesters are carrying a flag banned by the Ethiopian government. The flag looks much like Ethiopia's official flag, but it's missing the national emblem that symbolizes, as the Constitution states, the hopes of the nations, nationals, peoples, as well as religious communities of Ethiopia to live together in equality and unity. That emblem was added by EPRDF when it implemented the new constitution. Here's audio from the protests in Berlin earlier this year. And here's Deacon Yosef Tafari holding an anti-government rally in front of a municipal court building in Aurora, Colorado, as U.S. Representative Mike Kaufman is seated behind him, smiling.
And you have to make the pact with us, not with the world.
Therefore, the honorable congressman, we take your pledge and your promise that you've given to us. This is a strong promise that we will, in fact, back you up throughout your effort to make sure not even a dime of the United States taxpayers' money would finance a regime. And I want to make one more point, and that is, Congressman Hoffman, I want you to see our decorated flag, our national flag. It's a tricolor flag.
WikiLeaks cables from 2005 through 2009 revealed the U.S. pressured former Prime Minister Meles Zenawi to release opposition leaders despite their unwillingness to renounce violence or to adhere to Ethiopian laws. Top officials in EPRDF became wary of the U.S. and its agenda after learning U.S. officials met with the Ogaden National Liberation Front and other opposition groups outlawed by Ethiopia. The cable appears to mistakenly cite the Oromo Liberation Front instead of the Ogaden National Liberation Front. In either case, both groups are at war with the Ethiopian government and have been classified as terrorist organizations by the government. Former Prime Minister Meles Zenawi told Western diplomats on a number of occasions that their support for the opposition groups provided the groups with false hope and discouraged them from negotiating with the government. He said the groups had become emboldened to disregard Ethiopian laws and to take up violence as a means of accomplishing their objectives. In 2014, members of the opposition group stormed into the Ethiopian embassy in Washington, D.C. and removed the official flag and attempted to replace it with the flag banned by the Ethiopian government. An alarmed and furious official from the government blocks them and opens fire into the air in an attempt to stop them. The group continues to approach him undeterred. The official backs up into the building with his gun pointed at the group as they continue to walk towards him with their flag. Finally, a security force of some sort escorts the group out of the compound. The U.S. charged the official with assault and intent to kill, according to the Washington Post, and denied Ethiopia's request to grant the official diplomatic immunity. He was given the choice to face the charges or leave the country. The U.S. did not charge any members of the group involved in the incident. In a news report on the incident by the U.S. government-funded Voice of America, reporter Pamela Docking includes a misplaced and malicious quote from an anti-government protester. Here's the quote. I'm protesting to tell America and the American people, TPLF is a terrorist group. They take over and become a government and are still terrorizing East Africa. End quote. Let's go back to the 1991 hearings, because so much of what was said then applies now, except for this time, the U.S. seems to have switched sides. Here's consultant Paul Henze from earlier in the episode speaking.
But I have been in touch over a long period of time with most of the contending forces in Ethiopia, and in very close touch, particularly over the past year, with the two groups who have been most effective in bringing the downfall of Mengistu's regime, the EPLF and the EPRDF, with the TPLF an important component of it. I'm convinced that these people, whatever some of their past statements may have been, whatever some of their past conduct may have been, have learned very important lessons. They are aware of what's been happening in the world. They're also aware of what's happened in their own country. Their record in the areas that they have been administering in the past few years is basically very good. They deserve our confidence. And we must be cautious, I think, about not letting some of the controversy that still rages among Ethiopian exile groups and contending forces hinder or unduly influence the decisions that we make to facilitate recovery and facilitate the establishment of democracy in Ethiopia.